Hello and welcome to Season 13, Episode 25 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday, the 8th of September, and in this show we're going to be discussing some community news and events and some news headlines. And joining me this week, as ever, it's Alan.
Hello, it's nearly Christmas.
I knew you were going to say that.
And it's Martin.
It's not nearly Christmas, it's warm again. It's got warm again.
I know. I've had my window open all day and everything.
I've had the fan on.
Gosh. Oh, dear. Well, what else have you been up to other than sitting with the fan on, Martin?
I have been watching The Mandalorian.
Oh, it's good, isn't it?
It's absolutely brilliant. Have you seen it?
I have. I've seen, well, yeah, what's been shown so far, I think. Season one, or whatever they call it, parts one to whatever. However they named it, yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, there's just the right balance of sort of moodiness and humour and story and, you know, the things that people like about Star Wars.
Yes, so this is a serial drama from the, you know, the Star Wars universe, and it sits between the collapse of the Empire and the start of the First Order.
Yes.
And it follows the story of a bounty hunter who is a Mandalorian. So this is the look that most people will associate with Boba Fett.
Yes. It's also quite interesting. There's a lot of references they make. When Disney took over Star Wars, they said basically, you know, anything that's not the official films or cartoon series is no longer, you know, official dogma, as it were. It was decanonized and sent into an expanded universe thing. I think they called it Star Wars Legends or something. But actually in The Mandalorian, they make a references to quite a lot of lore, which is about, you know, it's mentioned in video games and comics and things like that. It's quite nice to see sort of nods to that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, I am not a Star Wars aficionado. You know, I couldn't explain to you the timelines of all of the stories and how they intersect accurately, but I do love the stories. And I tell you what, for storytelling alone, this was just absolutely wonderful. Although, so I think this finished airing when it first premiered, it concluded at like, in December last year. So I'm late to the party, but I've been seeing images online of what can only be described as a baby Yoda, and I now understand where these pictures come from, because that had passed me by entirely.
Yes.
Is Jean-Luc Picard in it?
No, unfortunately not. I'm hoping he's going to make an appearance in season two.
I have not seen this. This is on a paid subscription channel, isn't
yes,
it? You've got
Disney
yourself
Plus.
Disney,
right? Yeah. Yes. So did you watch it on Disney Plus, Mark, or some other service?
On advice of Council, yeah, I declined to answer is the right words to say here, Mark.
I'm just thinking what else I might have legitimately watched it on. I did watch it on Disney Plus, yes. Having a small child coming into the house made us decide that Disney Plus was a worthwhile purchase. Mm. That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, we've just, so I say we, I made a case for getting a Disney Plus subscription on the fact that it was mostly the stuff that was available on Disney Plus that was in my now defunct Plex server that we couldn't access through other streaming services that we have access to. And I made a case for, instead of buying new discs to repair the Plex server, we could have 5 years of Disney Plus, you know, membership instead. So that's what we're doing. And that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Thanks for those discs you no longer need, Martin.
They don't work. You're welcome to have them, but they don't do anything.
Right, and with that, let's get on with the show. And now it's time for community news and, in a change to our regularly scheduled programme, events. First up in the community news this week, Alan.
So Stuart Langridge wrote a blog post about making apps for Linux, and he wrote it as a proposal. And I had a bit of a hand in this. Earlier in the year, there was a GNOME community engagement challenge where they would accept proposals for projects And I'm being kind of hand-wavy and non-specific because lots of different types of projects would have been accepted.
Right.
And there were multiple rounds, phases of this thing, and we made a proposal and we didn't get through the first round. So so we decided to just publish the document that we put forward to the challenge anyway, in case somebody might want to build something based on the proposal we made.
So is this related to the makealinux.app website?
No, completely unrelated to that.
Completely unrelated, but also involving both of you and about making apps for Linux.
Yes, there is a theme. I'm not, if nothing, consistent. So, the goal of this was to get people engaged with building apps for Linux, but getting them started without throwing them at code, but making it more straightforward. So a kind of step beyond Scratch, where you're not dragging and dropping elements on the screen. You are actually typing to get you used to typing things, but it's not code in the conventional sense, in that it's more natural language where you say, this is a button which is above this field on the screen, and this is a value which is calculated by doing this. And so you can naturally describe the screen, and as you type, it automatically creates the display, and underneath it, it generates code that is then usable, is Python under the covers.
So is this something like, are you familiar with the language Gherkin for writing automated tests?
I'm not.
Okay, so that's... you might write an automated test in Gherkin by saying something like, I go to this web page and I click the button that says create new post, and I type this text in the message box and I press OK. Would you do something similar to that?
Similar, yeah. Very similar kind of thing. And you could say this is an orange gradient, from top to bottom. And so the idea was that we would get through phase one, and there was a monetary reward for getting through each of the phases in this challenge.
Oh, did you lose your deposit?
No. You don't have to pay to submit. And a bunch of projects did get through.
Yeah.
Ours didn't. And I'm sure they're very worthwhile and they'll turn into excellent pieces of software or initiatives. But ours was mostly a proposal of something that we really wanted to see happen. But because we couldn't justify it, because as a spare time project, we just didn't have the spare time to do it. If there was going to be some kind of payment for it, then we could justify Stuart not spending his time working, but spending time on this thing. But because there was no, financial reward for this, then we decided, well, we'll just open it up and somebody can take a look. And it's called Cabin, which we had a nice picture of a laptop in a cabin in the woods to focus on creating an application. But that's the idea.
Did you get to go to the cabin in the woods to take that picture?
No, I went to Unsplash and got a royalty-free image from there, which we doctored slightly so it doesn't look like a Mac.
I see. I noticed the Ubuntu desktop. I thought you might have been there. Yeah,
that was very cleverly done by Stuart. It was good fun, and it was really an engaging process to sit with him and understand what the proposal might be. He did the most of the work, but you can read it in his blog post.
Martin, what's up next?
So I read with interest that UKUI, which is the desktop environment for Ubuntu Chillin, has made some major visual changes.
Ooh.
Yeah, it looks really pretty. What I found interesting about this is I learned something new as I read about this. So UKUI, some years ago now, started out as a fork of the Mate desktop. And I've not been tracking the development very closely, but I learned that most of the front-end applications in UKUI are now implemented in Qt, not GTK. So... it not only has it gone through quite the significant visual refresh over the years, but they've also switched toolkits out. And I did a bit of, hunting around, but a lot of the back-end capabilities are still forks or using the back-end Mate components for things like session managers and settings daemons and things of that nature. So that was very interesting for me to look at this. But I have to say, a bit like the Deepin desktop environment, which I've always appreciated sort of the visual quality of that desktop environment. This really has some significant sort of polish and a fresh take on what, you know, a desktop environment could and should be for Linux. So it's definitely worth a look. I'll be interested to take this one for a test drive when Groovy launches later in the year.
We'll be taking some notes.
Well, I mean, I can't compete. I mean, you know, I don't know how many people they have working on this, but it's clearly, you know, they've got a lot of momentum behind it because there's a lot of quality in the work that's been done there.
I like the sidebar. It's very reminiscent of, you know, a few things. It's a modern thing to have this thing pop in from the right-hand side that's got notifications and controls and things. And when you look at the images on the OMG article, which we'll link to, you can see some of the animated GIFs that show how they operate some of the little buttons to turn things on and off. And it's kind of got the Windows 10 vibe of you slide it in and there's a whole bunch of buttons that, you know, you can activate and deactivate. But it's also very reminiscent of Android. So it'd be very familiar to someone who's okay with using Android on a phone. Those round icons that go gray when they're disabled will be very familiar to anyone using Android. And so it makes the Linux desktop maybe not quite so scary. Maybe we shouldn't be trying to ape Windows 10, but ape Android, because it's more familiar for a lot of people.
It's interesting you say that, because UK UI did very much used to take its sort of design language inspiration from Windows. But this version, as you pointed out, is very much not a Windows-esque take on things.
Next up, Todoist now has an official app for Linux. So Todoist is a to-do list software with a back-end service, is that right?
It is. I use Todoist.
Ah, okay. Tell us about Todoist.
It's the first... I've been using it... I think I've been a paying customer for about 18 months now. And it was the first, like, to-do list thing that made sense to me. And most importantly, it's the only one I've ever kept up using.
Is it, can you use it with multiple users so you can share it for a to-do list for the family, or is it just a single person to-do list? Or
I've never actually tried to do that. I've only ever used it for my own stuff. The reason for that being my wife still uses a Filofax. So, you know, I simply can't share my to-do list entries with her Filofax.
Looking at the description in the article, it does say there are some advanced capabilities, including collaborators, lots of collaborators on each project. So it does seem like, you know, per project, you can have a bunch of collaborators and multiple projects and all that kind of stuff. So it looks like that is something you can do.
One of the big draws for me was it's got good cross-device support. So I've been using it. I use an application called Wavebox, which is like a way to connect to different online applications and keep it all tidy, so you don't have like a million browser tabs of all of your desktop applications. So I use this for accessing, you know, Gmail and the G Suite and Todoist and a few other things that I'm sort of in regularly. So I've been using it via that, but I've now switched to their bespoke desktop application, and then I have it on my phone.
Is it better?
I like that visual separation of opening an application and it sits in its own window and it's manipulated in its own way. So I just like that. And that's the main reason why I use it. But it's no different from me doing it that way than how I was using it in Wavebox. But I just prefer that this is the official app from them. It's implemented as an Electron app. So, you know, I'm fine with that. I know some people aren't, but, you know, full disclosure. But yeah, I'm very happy with it. I really like it.
Alan, tell us about some HPs.
So there's some new certified laptops from that there HP, and they all feature that Z or Z. I don't know if they're ZBooks or ZBooks, but I'm going to call them
ZBooks.
They're ZBooks, aren't they? Yes. So they've got some interesting names: ZBooks Fury G7 15 and 17. I assume that's the size of the screens. And they've got Intel CPUs in these things and NVIDIA Quadro RTX GPUs. So they're, you know, kind of top end laptops. Mm. They're not your, you know, highly portable, low end, ultrabook style, although they don't look like great big chunky behemoths. They've certainly got a bit of heft to them. but they're not like ludicrously thick, you know, like gaming laptops, that kind of thing. But they're certified to run Ubuntu 20.04 and come pre-installed as an option with Ubuntu 20.04, which is pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah. So this, I'm really delighted to see this news. So this is HP's first outing with their Ubuntu pre-installed laptops for the consumer market. So in the past, if you wanted HP pre-installed with Ubuntu, you'd have to go through your, you know, HP sales rep and all the rest of it, business customers only. But while these are all going to be available, and I think it spans some 15 configurations or so, these will all be available with Ubuntu 20.04. But their website won't be updated until September the 14th, where you can actually pick Ubuntu as the operating system option. So it's we're a week away. As we record this, we're a week away from that becoming available. But, you know, criticisms in the past have been that it hasn't been easy to access the Ubuntu pre-install configuration options on OEM laptops, and HP are going to make it, you know, one-click option when you build out your configuration. But this is some months of work, you know, from the desktop team and the OEM delivery team at Canonical. And it's just the start for the work we're doing with HP. So I'm really looking forward to later in the year because I know what's coming next.
Okay, Martin, tell us about Elementary OS.
Well, Elementary OS is very pretty, and they've been working on adding experimental support for the Pinebook Pro. Ooh. So they're offering an early access build of Elementary OS 6, and I think, Alan, you've had a play with this, right?
Yeah, we talked about it last week.
Yeah.
On the Pinebook Pro. I have a little SD card on my desk with it on. And yeah, it is early access in that, you know, it's a bit busted in places, a bit slow in places. There's some work needed to improve that kind of stuff. They say it's not production ready, and it's not quite all polished. But they're really keen to make that a first-class citizen for them as a supported device, so that, you know, you can maybe in the future buy one with Elementary pre-installed, and maybe the Elementary project get, you know, some monetary support via that, in the same way that some other projects are getting support. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly, I mean, they're doing it as an experiment for now, mm-hmm. but it could certainly be the first of a number of devices that they focus on to get the hardware right. They're not, rather than, you know, what we do with Ubuntu, where we try and make it work across everything, they can, as a small team, can just focus on that one device and get it working really well on that one device. Interesting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we talked about this last week, but it's another stepping stone towards people showing interest in running desktop operating system on ARM devices these days.
Next up, Ubuntu 2010 is adding Active Directory support to the installer.
It is true.
Yes. So this is going to allow people to set up Active Directory at install time for sort of enterprise deployments. This is for authentication, I guess, for people who aren't familiar with what Active Directory is.
That's right. So this has been implemented by Didier Roche and Jean-Baptiste from the Ubuntu desktop team. And as you can tell from their names, they're both from Croydon. And what this enables you to do is in the Ubuntu installer from 2010, what would become 2010, is when you do the user configuration, you can elect to say, actually, I would like to authenticate with an Active Directory domain, and it will take you through the steps of choosing your domain and enrolling your user credentials for that laptop or device, you know, workstation, into that domain. So from that point forward, you'll authenticate with Active Directory. And similar to the HP news earlier, this is number two on the list of things enterprise customers and OEMs want to see in Ubuntu. Right, so this is why we've been working on it.
So was there already support for doing the Active Directory authentication? It's just this is then making it possible to set it all up at install time.
Right.
Rather than having to do it post-install.
Yeah, there were some lengthy guides you could follow to install a bunch of packages and configure PAM and a whole bunch of other stuff. And this is now, you know, three buttons in a UI at install time.
Excellent.
Is there any plan to backport this to 2004?
Maybe. So yes, I think almost inevitably we will introduce this to a 2004 point release. We need to polish this work, and we've done this work in collaboration with the Ubuntu server team, who are using the same underlying technologies in order to improve the way that you can authenticate server logins. And that was asked for by Microsoft for their Azure cloud deployments.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant.
Alan, what's up next?
GNOME Power Profiles Daemon is apparently taking shape for better system and laptop power controls. What this basically means is there's going to potentially be some power profiles that you can switch between on your laptop, between, power saver, if you want to sip the power from the battery and you want to get the longest possible battery life, balanced, if you want a bit of, do a bit of intense processing, but also hopefully keep your battery going, and then performance, if you're doing some intense work and you don't really care about battery life. And apparently you'll be able to switch these, I think. Potentially dynamically switch them as well. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work, but I've always been very skeptical of these things, because I've always felt like underneath the covers, this stuff should just work and you shouldn't have to, as a human being, fiddle with, you know, these power profiles. They always felt like a little bit of snake oil and, not really something super useful, but I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe actually it is super useful to be able to have the CPU never clock down. I always feel like you should allow the CPU to just clock up when it needs to and then clock down when it determines that there's not a lot going on, which I guess is balanced. But what do they do in power save? Do they just not ramp the CPU up, in which case your laptop feels slow all the time? Or I don't know. And if you put it in performance mode, is it ramped up most of the time and therefore the battery dies and your fan is spinning all the time? I don't know. It just feels like a weird thing for a human to interfere with.
Yeah, this is interesting, because I know the GNOME project have talked about like doing precisely what you describe, which is automatically determine what the power state of the device should be based on what it's doing. But there is a desire for users to be able to influence that. And this is what this achieves. And it's broader than simply tuning the CPU utilization. It will expand into preferences within the desktop to change the way that animations happen and things like that, for example, or the way that USB devices are managed. And I see that they've already started to flesh out their plans for how this can hook into AMD GPU power management as well, because that has some tunables there. I think this will be popular. And whilst I agree, you know, having a human sort of dictate, this is how I want the power profile of my machine to behave, it's what people are accustomed to from other platforms. So it's kind of meeting that experience as well. And I know, again, you know, we talked about HP earlier. This is one of the features that the tier one OEMs want to see in the Linux desktops, because it's feature parity with what you get elsewhere.
If they've got snake oil, we have to have snake oil too.
It is interesting that it keeps coming around to this, is that, you know, the OEMs, they want Ubuntu, but they don't want it to be that different.
Well, the thing is that, all of those laptops that are pre-installed with Ubuntu have to go through Energy Star certifications.
Right.
And if they don't meet certain power limits under certain conditions, those fail. And then it's quite expensive to have to go back through and re-enroll those into another certification process. So this also helps the OEMs get through their Energy Star ratings without multiple stabs at it.
Right. And finally, we have an event. The people-powered community building book club is happening every Tuesday at 9 a.m. PST from October the 6th to December the 15th, and it's online. I'm not sure what PST is compared to where we are, but I'm sure the internet can tell you.
Pacific. So that's what, 8 hours behind us or something like that? Something like this.
So it'll be sometime in the afternoon UK time. So this is an 11-week online book club for the people-powered book by John O'Bacon. The group's going to read the book with discussion on Slack and a weekly Q&A video session with Jono. And it's going to be entirely online. It's free and it will run from October the 6th to December the 15th. And the Q&A calls will be every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time. And I think you have to go and sign up ahead of time if you want to be involved.
You do. You have to sign up by October the 2nd. Right. And we'll have a link in the show notes as to where you go and do that.
Great. And that's all the community news and events. And now it's time for the news headlines. And first up in the news this week, Martin.
I'm going to be installing a Windows 10 machine, it appears, because it looks like Fall Guys, the game that I was talking about recently that I've been thoroughly enjoying playing with my daughter,
yeah,
is going to be using the same anti-cheat software found in Fortnite. And that will probably mean it will no longer be able to play the game under Linux using Proton.
Ah, right. So there wasn't already a Linux port for this. You were just playing it via Proton, and this breaks Proton support.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, that's sad.
This serves as a bit of a PSA, I suppose, to anyone who heard us talking about Fall Guys and thought you wanted some of that fun because it runs on Linux. Buyer beware. That may not be the case for much longer.
Right. So is this basically because people were hacking about with Fall Guys,
yes,
locally and making it not so much fun for other people?
Yes, exactly that. People were just like, you know, skipping right to the end of a level, and you'd get multiple people hacking in the same game. And so, different players all hacking. All the people who weren't hacking got knocked out because it's a battle royale.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, all you're left with is two hackers trying to beat it out, trying to, you know, outwit each other, which is no fun for everyone. I mean, it probably will be minor fun for a spectator sport, but it isn't a spectator sport. It's a game you play.
Right. I see.
So yeah, I think people are a bit frustrated. And so the company that make Fall Guys have been tweeting out, you know, apologies, and we're going to add this in. And yeah, a bit sad for anyone who runs it under Proton.
Yes. Alan, what's been going on in Minecraft?
Well, good news, everyone. Pack.png has been found.
I have no idea what this means.
So, let me tell you a story. Way back in the days when Notch maintained, Notch being Marcus Pearson, the guy who first created Minecraft, when he first maintained Minecraft, he added a little PNG, a little image that's like 200 by 100 pixels. It's tiny. And it's a screen grab of the game, and it's an icon that's used in the game. Mm-hmm. At the point when you're choosing a multiplayer server to join, there's a little default image next to the server name, and the default image is called pack.png. And for a long time, people have wondered, where did that image come from? It came from the game. It's a screenshot that's been cropped and shrunk, but which server did it come from, or which world did it come from? And with Minecraft, if you create a brand new world, it's started and randomly generated, procedurally generated, shall I say, based on a random number seed. And if you don't specify one, then it's random. But you can specify one. But at the time when Notch created that image, he didn't make a note of what that seed was. And so nobody knew what the one seed out of 200 trillion or whatever they are was the one that would make the world where you could see the hill that's in this little pack.png. And so the internet went to work and they used AI and lots of GPUs to compute and calculate and brute force and figure out which was the one seed that would generate the world in which they could visit this hill that appears in pack.png.
How long has the internet been working on solving this problem?
I'm not sure how long they've been working. I mean, people have wondered about it for a long time. Right. And someone set up had a Discord server where they were coordinating this effort. A notch turned up in the Discord server. And so they were asking him, you know, where did it come from? And he was like, I've got no idea. I approve of this, this initiative to figure out what the seed is. And it was only this week that, that they actually found it, and we'll put the seed number and the X and Z coordinates in the world. If you want to go there, you can just create a world, give it this seed, go to this location, and you can see the hill that is represented in the pack.png that is still in Minecraft now.
So this is more complicated than you've outlined, because not only do you need to know the seed, you need to know the point of origin that you need to look at the thing in order to qualify that that is the thing that you're looking.
Yeah.
Does this now mean that pack.png is going to get a super high res, you know, remaster now?
Well, interestingly, as part of the process, people upscaled it to try and figure out if they could get details of what the landscape was like. Because one of the things they wanted to do was analyze the landscape, see what type of flowers they were and other vegetation, so they could find that plot of land in the various servers that they generated. And they used the Boink, I think it's called, the distributed computing system, in order to farm this work out, because it would be impossible.
So this was like a brute force attack. They basically kept generating worlds and then kept checking if they were right.
Towards the end, yes. But initially, they filtered some things out and they could, you know, reduce the scope down dramatically. Yeah, so right. They didn't have to necessarily spin up 2 trillion worlds, no.
This wasn't an infinite number of monkeys with an infinite number of GPUs.
Well, virtual monkeys with virtual, yeah, with GPUs, yes, basically. But it's just a lovely little story that I thought was quite delightful, how given a tiny little PNG, people can find the origin of it with enough GPUs.
Next up, in Nintendo fanboy news, Nintendo announced Super Mario 3D All-Stars.
Gosh, what's that?
Right. Did either of you have a Super Nintendo?
No.
I still have one. Still plugged into my TV right now.
So on Super Nintendo, there was a game you could buy called Super Mario All-Stars, which was a collection of the original Super Mario games, which were originally on the NES, but redone with SNES graphics and all compiled onto one cartridge. And, you know, it was obviously really popular because you've got these classic games. Even then, they were classic games, all, you know, three or four for the price of one. And they've done it again, but this time with a bit more of a modern twist. So the main Mario games for the Nintendo 64, GameCube and the Wii, which was Super Mario 64, Super Mario Sunshine and Super Mario Galaxy, I think was the third one, are going to be re-released for the Nintendo Switch.
Oh.
Yes. So I did have a Wii and I had a GameCube, but I never had a Nintendo 64. And Super Mario fans tend to rave about Super Mario 64 as an absolute classic, but yes. I've never actually played it myself. I did play Super Mario Sunshine and that is brilliant fun. Yeah. So I'm very much looking forward to getting this and playing through it all.
I was playing Super Mario Sunshine just last week. I dug out my GameCube and I've been playing a few old GameCube games on my TV in my bedroom. It's been quite fun.
Yes, it's just the sort of exploring the worlds and finding all of the just little hidden secrets, and you see a little detail out of the corner of your eye and you think, I bet you there's something up there. And then you spend like about half an hour trying to work out the right series of jumps to get up there. And there was something there just as you expected. I find it very satisfying to play.
That's great.
And finally, it's been announced that Neil Buchanan is not Banksy.
Isn't he though?
So for those of you who weren't children of the 90s in the UK, Neil Buchanan used to present a children's television program called Art Attack, where he would do various sort of arts and crafty things that you could do at home, mostly out of poster paint and toilet roll tubes, as I remember. And this story just tickled me because it appears that there was a rumor going around for a while that Neil Buchanan had died, and he had to issue a statement saying, no, I'm not dead. And now he's had to issue a statement saying, no, I'm not Banksy. Banksy is a famous anonymous graffiti artist in the UK who does murals in unexpected places.
And pictures that destroy themselves.
Yes, and pictures that destroy themselves and, you know, usually sort of socio-political commentary sorts of things. And, you know, there's always ideas about who he might be and rumours, and nothing's ever been proven. But there was enough of a story going around that it was Neil Buchanan that he then had to, or his management had to issue a statement saying, no, Neil Buchanan is not Banksy. Yeah. And that tickled me this week.
He says that, but yeah.
But it's exactly what he'd say if he was Banksy. Totally would,
yeah. Is he Satoshi?
And that's all in the news headlines this week. And that's all for episode 25. Thank you all very much for listening. We'll be back next week when we talk about old technology and being old. If you'd like to chat to us in between shows, you can find us on ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. And we would like to thank everybody who contributes to our monthly Patreon subscription and keeps us sounding as good as we do. So thank you to everyone who supports the show. And if you'd like to support us yourself, you can find a link on our website.